Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am here with Richard Spencer. Richard, great having you back on.
Well, thanks for asking me on, Robert. It's a pleasure.
So we're going to be discussing some of the issues relating to the shooting in South Carolina and the culture, kind of the culture war issues we're in right now, issues dealing with the Confederate flag and the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. Richard, you wrote this article about a week ago, Dylan Roof and Political Violence, and you also did a podcast with James Edwards from the Political Cesspool about the event.
Yes, I did.
What is the significance, what has traditionally been sort of the significance of political violence?
Well, that's a good question, because political violence is something that most people in contemporary America think is just inherently wrong and evil and is never justified. The notion that you would kill someone or destroy property or threaten someone or terrorize someone in order to achieve an end is just, you know, anathema. We'd like to always say you do this peacefully through protesting, or you run for office, or you vote, or whatever. But the fact is, political violence has been the way history has been made for millennia, and it's just a fact. We live in a kind of bubble, end of history bubble, if you will, at which point we think that political violence is either immoral or kind of inherently unworkable. You know, it's bound to fail or something like that. But that's certainly not the case historically. Historically, maybe using a word like terrorism, that might be a little too much, might have too many contemporary resonances and connotations. But the fact is, this is how regimes change. This is how new paradigms are introduced. This is how a power will establish its sovereignty, is ultimately through violence. You can see it's not that there isn't peace in world history. I'm speaking, I'm using very broad brushstrokes here. Politics is really, it's based on violence and it's about using violence. So anyway, what I was just thinking about these matters when I was thinking about Dylan Roof and also someone like Anders Breivik. Anders Breivik, again, if we don't want to read this as some a conspiracy or false flag or patsy or whatever, and I'm, you know, I think we should always be skeptical without question. But let's just take these events at face value and consider them genuine, consider their manifestos, quote-unquote, genuine, so on and so forth. Clearly, there's a connection between Dylan Roof and Anders Breivik in the sense that they both wanted to send a message. This wasn't a suicide. It wasn't this girl was dating me and then she dumped me and I'm going to go kill her. So it wasn't something like that. It was two people who felt that they had to do something, that they had to send a message, that someone had to do something, and they couldn't just remain silent. Now, I think both of those people, let's put Breivik aside, but certainly Dylan Roof, I think there's a lot of signs that he was seriously mentally ill. But nevertheless, even within his own madness, he wanted to send a message.
And, I mean, even, I think with the mental illness thing, I think it has been used to sort of, someone can be mentally ill but still be brilliant. I know with the Unabomber, sure, Ted Kaczynski, he actually could have had an insanity plea, but he rejected because he rejected the insanity plea, even though it would have granted him more leniency because it would repudiate his views.
Right. No, without question. There's a lot of cliches about, you know, that genius is, you know, the distance between genius and madness is, you know, only a matter of success or something like that. Yes, without question, there are people. Beethoven was probably mad in many ways. Yes, there are certainly just the fact that someone is mentally unstable doesn't mean that you shouldn't take them seriously or you shouldn't think that they can produce good. Obviously, in the case of Roof, he produced a lot of evil because even if you remove yourself from the liberal morality of any kind of political violence is totally unjustified. You must go vote or run for office. That is the only way to change things. Even if you divorce yourself from that and say that sometimes using violence for a cause is effective and right, even if you take that perspective, Dylan Roof's actions were either evil or stupid, depending on your perspective. I mean, if he truly did care about these issues of the issues that apparently he cared about, reading his fugitive manifesto, he cared about white rights, he cared about black and white crime, he cared about white consciousness, so on and so forth, and Southern identity and pride. So even if we divorce ourselves from this liberal perspective that political violence is inherently immoral and that the only way to achieve anything is through voting or persuasion or running for office, so on, and we take a hardened realist perspective that yes, sometimes political violence is necessary, even if we take that more Machiavellian perspective, if you will, the actions of Dylan Roof are just, it cannot be justified. It wasn't just a crime morally, it was a mistake. It was stupid. I mean, he set back the cause he claimed to fight for, in the sense that this was basically an excuse for more groveling, for Southern institutions to claim just how non-racist they really are. It was a catalyst that led to taking down, removing the Confederate flag from various state houses. So in that sense, and in the sense of utter political, brutal political realism, this was a deeply stupid act. And I guess what I was getting at in the second half of my article, and what I think is really the takeaway from this, is that we have to be both idealistic and realistic, and that is taking into account the situation in which we're in. I think we need to be hyper idealistic in the sense that so much of the left and right in the United States and really around the Western world is brain dead. It has no more great ideals. It no longer has these big utopias or this telos that it's fighting for, some road it's taking down to utopia, like the image of communism or the image of tradition and hierarchy or anything. So I think both left and right are fundamentally bankrupt. If you see what people argue about, in at least I'm just taking American examples, it's whether we need to have less regulation for small business or whether we need to subsidize birth control for college students. I mean, it's very small-minded junk, and I think that we should basically ignore it. It's not important. It is frivolous and ephemeral, and we should think about the really big things. Where do we want to be 100 years from now? What kind of society do we want our grandchildren to live in? Those are the kinds of big ideas that can inspire a new movement and that certainly inspire me. So I think we need to do that, but we also need to be hyper-realist. And, I can remember back in 2008, in the fall and winter of 2008, 2009, and seeing these, stock market crashes and organizations that were effectively government organizations backed by the government collapsing, and normal middle class people wondering about if they're going to have any net worth and wondering about the future, and there was a lot of talk of apocalypse. You know, you could look at the Huffington Post and they would be talking about survivalism and, you know, economic collapse. And I think in a way, a lot of people were inspired by this. There was a great deal of negative social mood, and we think that, oh, wow, there's going to be a paradigm shift and we could ride this wave to victory or something like that. I think everyone was kind of caught up in that spirit. It was a great big Schadenfreude, so to speak. But the fact is, and we need to be realistic about this, is the fact is that the modern world is quite stable. And you do see some cracks in the facade, like even Greece leaving the EU, the monetary union, this so-called Grexit. That is a crack in the facade. I think this just kind of overt suppression of white symbols of their history and heritage, whatever you want to think about the Confederate flag, just this overt suppression of it, I think that's a crack.
So the thing with the political violence, like what he did was extremely idiotic, but I think what it is with individuals who lash out like this, they feel like they have nothing to lose and nothing to live for, and a feeling of hopelessness that nothing can be changed for the better, that there's no positive ways, nothing
without
to be
question.
Optimistic.
But they do have something to live for. I mean, I think this gets back to what I was saying, is that we need to be idealistic, but we also need to be realistic. And the fact is, despite these cracks in the facade that I mentioned, the modern world is ultimately a stable one, at least for the time being, and I would think for the foreseeable future. Again, I might get back in these heady days of revolution if we have a stock market crash in the fall. But the fact is, this world is stable. There are people who are expert managers who are able to keep things going. They're able to determine where the trouble spots are, and they're able to work through them. So we aren't in a position where going out onto this. I mean, I don't think what Dylann Roof did, killing people in church, it was just so shockingly bad of an idea as a form of political violence that I don't think there's any context in which that is conceivably justified. But we're not in a position where violence is going to be effective.
Yeah, that's the thing, is violence is effective when a group has a monopoly in violence, like a state or a political organization. They're in a position of power, but if a group is totally
without question,
powerless, then it's not effective.
The state is able to engage in horrifying violence. Ultimately, I mean, the fact is, if you look at the estimates of deaths in the Iraq War, they range from a couple hundred thousand up to a million. And, you know, so the government, and that includes the Obama administration, it obviously includes the Bush administration. And you can go back further and look at bombings by Clinton. The fact is, all of these Democratic and Republican presidents, liberal and conservative, they have killed a tremendous amount of people. And it is not considered murder. It's considered casualties or attacks on soldiers. So the state is without question able to engage in violence. But there are moments when extra-legal violence can be justified. There are moments when people look at the violence of a partisan or the violence of a non-state actor as justified. And, you know, there are obviously plenty of examples of this in our history. And there are plenty of examples when it becomes out of control, when extra-legal, extra-state violence consumes society. And I'm thinking of the wars of religion or things like this. But the fact is, there are moments when extra-legal violence can be justified. But now is not one of those moments. And even if we did something that was much better conceived than Dylann Roof's horrible act, it will be conceived as Dylann Roof. Because ultimately, people are the regime is stable, and ultimately people are happy.
I think the other thing is that the American public, and especially white Americans, are extremely sanctimonious. And you made this point in your podcast. It kind of goes back to the puritanical influence. And they're sanctimonious. I mean, they want to prove that they're a good and moral person. But at the same time, they're very selective about it. Like, they turn, a lot of people are very morally outraged, but at the same time, they turn a blind eye to extreme acts of barbarism on behalf of, like, well, you were pointing out how the U.S. military commits mass murder in Iraq. So,
yes,
but the society
again,
as a whole is very sanctimonious.
It's about word choice. Yeah, it's about word choice. You know, these sanctimonious conservatives who talk about how unracist they are, and they've adopted an African child and blah, blah, blah. But then they'll also go and, you know, oh, these soldiers are so brave. And, you know, again, I guess I have a different view of the acts of these soldiers, just because I think what they are doing, that is the geopolitics, the foreign policy of the United States, is just utterly stupid and wrong. So, I am more likely to see them as murderers, as kicking down doors and killing people for ultimately no reason. But these sanctimonious idiots in America, kind of, oh, look, the soldiers, you know. Oh, let's give discounts to soldiers and let soldiers get on planes before mere civilians. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it really is a question of semantics. It is whether you consider something mass murder, as you said, or whether you consider something casualties or just statistics of a war. That is really the question, and that's really a kind of moral, ideological turn in your head. There's ultimately no difference between a dead body who's been killed by a U.S. soldier, or a dead body in that church that was shot by Dylann Roof. They're the same corpse, but how we think of them is different, and that is something that is internal. It's in our minds. It's not really a fact of life. It's a way that we see things.
And I remember when the Anders Breivik massacre happened, a lot of people were predicting that the whole like nationalist movement in Europe would be shut down. But that didn't happen. If anything, I think it's in some ways it's stronger now than it was then. But I know like you had that incident where you were arrested in Hungary, so there was a lot of suppression. But it didn't happen to the degree that what people were predicting after the massacre.
No, I think it's actually fairly remarkable the degree to which Anders Breivik has not hampered the far right. I don't see new laws that have been implemented to suppress, you know, even not just say there are laws against things like Holocaust revisionism, which isn't necessarily a right wing or traditionalist viewpoint. It could be a left wing viewpoint or libertarian, whatever, but it's associated certainly with the far right. Those laws are already on the books for decades, but there have not been new ways of suppressing people. I think in a way the suppression of me was kind of a unique thing. It's actually a fascinating thing what happened. If you look at these dynamics at play, the kind of ethno-nationalist party that and then Jobbik's dealings with Viktor Orban's dealings with Jobbik and Viktor Orban's dealings with the left, Viktor Orban's way of straddling Russia and the United States, I think that was a kind of a unique thing. I don't think there's greater suppression than there is. So I think it's actually in a way remarkable that in 4 years the Breivik murder has not led to just a total crackdown on anything slightly to the right of Angela Merkel. And again, even with the Dylann Roof case, after it happened, you know, what did we hear? Gun control, gun control, gun control. I don't see that as having legs, really. I just think that this is a static issue. It's the forces, you know, to use a military metaphor here, that, I mean, the forces on each side of the trench just aren't going to move. And, you know, I don't think there's going to be new gun control laws. And what they ultimately did was they're taking down the Confederate flag, and that's it's a symbolic gesture. I mean, the idea that you're going to take down the Confederate flag and, you know, African-American test scores are going to rise, or something is just so preposterous. It shouldn't. You can't say it without chuckling. Basically, doing a meaningless symbolic gesture, and they're not doing anything with real teeth. If they started confiscating guns after that, that would be real. Go ahead.
Well, they were trying to say that Dylann Roof was a like product of like systematic racism, when basically he was someone who was totally marginalized. Yet they're saying that he's part of some kind of a massive power structure.
Yeah. Well, everyone projects onto these events what they want. I didn't even know this, but I heard something where at the very beginning, Fox News was talking about how this is the liberals' war on Christianity, that they were firing in a church. Yeah. So that didn't have many legs, so to speak. But then, you know, it's about gun control. It's about the Confederate flag. It's about racism, and so on and so forth. It just people project onto these events what they will. I think it's interesting, and we don't need to dwell on this matter, but I think it is worth pointing out that, A, the victims have been totally forgotten. I don't know any of their names. No one's talking about them. Everyone focuses on Dylann Roof. B, the one issue that this brings up that I think really is in need of a national conversation is mental health. And what I mean by that is we have this weird consciousness towards mental health where we love, and I'm talking about the American society, but this holds to a great degree for European society as well. We love pill popping. You know, if you have any bad feelings, just take this pill. We love that kind of thing. We're a heavily medicated society, but then we deny real mental illness. Like we think about the era of insane asylums. We think of those as like haunted houses or horror movies. Like they had no justification. They were just totally sadistic. But the fact is,
were people put into there against their will by force?
Yes, and that's the other way we think about it. But the fact is, mental illness is a real thing, and to a very large degree, it's not curable. And we don't like that as a society because we like to think of everyone as good, and you know, we can just take a pill and then you can be a good, upstanding citizen and voter. And we don't look at we don't stare into the abyss of mental illness. The fact is, it's a very disturbing thing. But there are people who are in serious need of care, and we as a society owe them something. And we should not just – I mean, I think we owed Dylann Roof something. We owed him care as opposed to making him this, you know, marginalized loser of society, which is what he became. And I think the reality of mental illness, insanity, I think that is something we do need to have a national discussion about. But of course we won't, because that goes against our favorite liberal paradigms. It goes against all the fairy tales we like to tell each other about how everyone's wonderful and everyone can be good and everyone should just come over to America from around the world and become freedom-loving citizens together. That doesn't fit that paradigm, and so we don't want to talk about it.
I think a lot of, like, with a lot of these different shooters, I don't necessarily think all of them are born with extreme mental illness. I think a lot of them are just angry and depressed.
Yes. Yeah, without question.
And I also think that if people feel really disconnected and alienated, I think that causes a lot of psychological problems on top of that.
Yes, I think Dylann, from what we know of Dylann Roof, he was clearly an isolated, marginalized individual. He had no real, you know, social net, so to speak. Or, you know, I think this is part of, in a way, the problem is that, you know, in earlier times, we could, in a way, do something with people who were incurably mentally ill or mentally retarded or so on and so forth, where there were things they could do. They could work on the farm. They could do this. And I think in a way, in society, we don't know what to do with them. We live in a hyper-modern, post-modern, post-industrial society. And so I think we need to think about this because we do owe these people something. And again, I think the ultimate, the way we want to lie about this is I saw some of these things where we want to send people with Down syndrome to college. So you can now, I think there was some video on YouTube of some, you know, someone who was seriously impaired, who had Down syndrome, getting his acceptance letter to college. So he's going to the University of Tennessee or something. And it's just like the notion that we should impoverish his parents, get them on student loans, give someone a worthless degree that is beyond worthless and just it's like a false currency, counterfeit. It ruins all the rest of the currency. Bad money drives out good. The fact that we would do this, that we want to lie about the reality of mental illness and serious mental retardation to this degree, I think it just shows how unserious Americans are.
What is your take on his manifesto? The thing about it is, with the exception of him using like some racial slurs, like 90% of it's actually fairly moderate.
Yeah, I agree. I've had a lot of people have said, "Oh, it sounds weird. I don't trust it. Why would he say this?" I don't know about that. It seems, if I were to guess, I would say it was genuine. But I do have skepticism. But if I were to guess, I would say he did write it. And I agree. You know, he used nigger a few times, and he threw out some things that people will read and they'll just be like, oh gosh, he was crazy. But if you actually kind of overlook some of those things and read what he wrote, it was fairly moderate. I mean, there were a lot of things that would be difficult for anyone actually to disagree with. And so I don't know what you could say. You could say that, does that in a way make it worse? Is the fact that he did murder, does he now delegitimize, you know, some of the most reasonable forms of white consciousness, like looking at asymmetry and crime, so on and so forth? You know, does this make it worse, the fact that he was actually somewhat reasonable, as opposed to going on there and yelling Heil Hitler and, you know, all this kind of stuff that is in a way kind of stupid and easily dismissed.
Yeah, because then they can say that basically a site like your website or the alternative right is like the equivalent of like the Daily Stormer. They'll say all those sites are no different from each other.
Right. Yeah. No. That is exactly why I was thinking it's almost worse. I wish he were just some crazed lunatic that would have made things easier. Certainly, you know, the CFCC basically, from what I understand, they don't really write their own articles. They basically link to local news stories, and so they're reposting local news stories. And so, you know, again, there's nothing. They weren't inciting violence. They were providing information. Yeah, I mean, the Council of Conservative Citizens website actually doesn't offer that much original material. What they do is that they repost local news stories, and so really they're providing information. They're not inciting anyone to commit violence. And again, I would say that, you know, going back to the theme of it might have been worse that his manifesto was reasonable in many places, is that, you know, the American Renaissance is certainly of a higher caliber than the CFCC, but, you know, American Renaissance reposts tons of articles on news about race and crime and so on and so forth. So, you know, in a way, the fact that he didn't mention Amren was lucky for Amren. But, you know, again, it gets to that point of is what Dylan is the fact that his manifesto had so many reasonable things. Is that actually really bad? Because it taints reasonable discussion, a serious discussion about racial matters and crime and similar topics.
He had an interesting comment on his manifesto that you mentioned about white people moving to the suburbs and basically saying that they're hypocrites because they're escaping those issues, but they won't say it publicly.
Well, he actually said they won't even say it to themselves. And I thought, again, I thought he was actually quite psychologically astute there. White people will talk about good schools, or they like this neighborhood, or it's such a fun neighborhood with some good shops and things like that. And they won't, even to themselves, perhaps, they won't even admit what they are doing. And that is that they are avoiding the consequences of mass immigration, and they're avoiding the consequences of African Americans. They are, in a way, you know, they are acting like people who are racially they're acting like people who are racially conscious. I would say they're kind of racially unconscious. And so the fact that he noted that is very interesting, and it shows this kind of, you know, this lie at the very heart of the suburbs, and this lie at the very heart of white consciousness. And so I think that was actually a very interesting and important thing he said.
So you commented on the whole sort of culture war thing. So your attitude towards the Confederate flag being taken down and gay marriage being legalized across the country is kind of saying, in a sense, you're saying that it's sort of good that the culture war is over, because you're saying that sort of a left versus right culture war and issues like gay marriage has been like a huge distraction.
Well, yeah, I actually didn't mention the Confederate flag and the culture war piece, because I agree that there is some connection between them. It's not purely rational. It's kind of temporal, but it's maybe symbolic too. I think that what we've seen in 1 week, the Confederate flag went down and the rainbow flag went up. And I don't think it was planned that way, but there seems to be some kind of psychic connection between these two events. That you know, that the president will make the White House rainbow, and this flag will stand. Not even, the flag doesn't even stand for gay marriage so much as for the United States as a liberal platform with a deeply liberal algorithm where new experiences of individual rights can be achieved for everyone on earth. That seems to be what the rainbow flag means. And the Confederate flag, without question, the Confederate flag could have, or was, and can be used as a symbol of white supremacy or Jim Crow or racism or anti-African-American animus. But what it ultimately was a way for white people to honor their ancestors. It was a way for them to honor fallen soldiers in this terrible conflict. And the fact that that is being taken away, that you can obviously still do this in places. There are Confederate war memorials all over the South. But just this symbolic action of taking it away was a kind of way of erasing white history and white heritage. And anyway, I think that is something real. Maybe you could even argue from a kind of Leninist perspective that this is good because it will wake.
Yeah, because then it becomes sort of the Confederate flag becomes more of a dissenting symbol, as opposed to, I guess if people see the flag up in front of the state capitals, they're like, yeah, this is our state capital.
Well, yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point about this idea that the Confederate flag could become a kind of dangerous dissenting symbol now, more than it was before. And I think, you know, again, I don't identify as a Southerner. I certainly have spent a lot of time there, and I went to the University of Virginia as an undergraduate, and I grew up in Texas. But nevertheless, I haven't really lived in the Deep South like others have, and so I don't really identify as a Southerner. But I would say that the Confederate flag today, it is obviously much, much more prevalent in the Deep South, of course, and some other states like West Virginia that didn't fight for the Confederacy. But anyway, it's much more prevalent there. But it's kind of a benign symbol. It's a kind of, maybe you could even say, but now it might be a different symbol and a more dangerous symbol. And you could say that when Southerners saw the Confederate flag billowing over the State House in South Carolina, they could say, well, you know, here in South Carolina, things are different. We're conservative. We aren't like the Yankees or something. We have a different culture. And when you take it down and it becomes a kind of dangerous alternative dissenting symbol, it might become more powerful. And it might take away that false consciousness that South Carolina really is different than the rest of the country, because it's not.
Because if you have, like, Confederate flags at, like, Walmart, and you have, like, neocons who support the military waving Confederate flags, then it kind of, like, that trashes its meaning.
I agree, because it's about remembering people who died in a terrible conflict. It is not about boosting the current American government. But, I mean, again, this is part of this, you could say, false consciousness or dual consciousness or whatever of Southerners. You know, they it is a more conservative region of the country, without question. But it's also one that is more nationalist. It's both more peculiarist and more nationalist at the same time. It both has a sense of themselves as Southerners, but then is more supportive of the federal government, at least in its war-making capacity, than people in, you know, Portland or Boston. And so it's a dual thing. And so I don't know. I mean, is what is this going to lead to? Is this going to lead to an awakened sense of Southern self, where they're going to begin thinking, we're not part of this country. They really hate us. We're something else. Or will it actually be a massive defeat where the Southern peculiar identity vanishes and it's just a, you know, Southern identity just becomes a conservative American identity? I don't know. All of those things are possible. But it is interesting. And it might actually, you know, I always look, I don't want to say I'm just like, I'm in a bright-eyed optimist, but I always look at the flip side of something and not just what don't just look at what people think this is going to be about. What Nikki Haley thinks it's going to be about is that South Carolina will be still have, you know, they'll still serve sweet tea and fried chicken and chicken fried steak or whatever, but it will be basically this global society and a post-white society. But will it? Might her actions actually have the reverse consequence? Maybe. It's certainly an interesting thing to think about. And there have been some Confederate flag rallies, across the South. I mean, these are fairly small. They're not as large as a Tea Party rally. They're not as large as when a Republican candidate comes. But maybe it's the start of something. I don't know.
So you have this article, Identitarianism, a Conversation Starter. And yeah. Identitarianism is a movement in Europe. Identitarian, you describe, I think a famous French sociologist described it as an identitarian withdrawal or a lack of assimilation among immigrants. So is he sort of implying as to adopt that same, like, basically the mainstream right complains about immigrants not assimilating, but what you're saying is we should become like them. Like, we should, instead of complaining about them not assimilating, we should not assimilate into the dominant culture either and develop our own identities.
Yeah, you could take it that way. I titled that piece A Conversation Starter because what that piece was about was inspiring people to write we are doing an essay contest, which if you go to RateExternal.com, you can read about it. If you're basically 30 years older or younger, you can enter an essay contest. We're actually giving $500 to the best essay and some other prizes, $100. So, you know, we want to make it worth your while. It's worth contributing an essay to. But basically, why I chose this was I think there is some, I think this identitarianism really, it really makes sense, and it is a powerful idea, and it's a very contemporary idea, and in a good way. It's one that really resonates with our lived experience. Bringing back Jim Crow or refighting the Civil War or refighting the Second World War, all of those strike me as false rights. That's unworkable, and it's not ideal. That's not what we want. And I think identitarianism really is something we do want. And you bring up a very good point in the sense that if you listen to the mainstream criticism, it's basically that the mainstream conservative criticism of, say, mass immigration, it is basically that, oh, these people aren't assimilating. And, you know, I guess it raises the question, do you want them to assimilate? Do you want millions of Mexicans or Puerto Ricans to enter the country and assimilate and just start speaking English perfectly? And this ultimately entails intermarriage, and it ultimately entails everyone losing their identity.
The end result of that is where everyone is mixed together, but we all have the sort of same bland consumer culture. We all shop at Walmart. We all eat fast food. It wipes out all cultures.
So in a sense, and that is what conservatism has become, effectively. You know, we had an interesting article at Radix that was that I think was kind of snobby and turned people off, but I think it actually had the underlying point was very important, and that was that the fact that Scott Walker was so proud that he shops at Joseph A. Bank, the conservative movement and the Republicanism has become kind of the ideology of a corporate middle management. It's become the idea of, you know, we wave the flag and we go to Crackle Barrel and Walmart. It's this kind of mass consumerist conformism, and it isn't a real identity. And I think, you know, that is something that we want to seek. We want to unassimilate from Americanism. I think that's very important for us. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And I think also why I think identitarianism is a powerful and good concept and why we should adopt it is that it gets away from things that I think are ultimately unworkable and tragic. I don't want to return to anything resembling the old South of a slave-owning region where Africans outnumbered whites in most regions, and where we had this just obviously unjust situation that was obviously going to lead to something bad, and that is racially defined slavery. It's just we don't want to return to that. We don't want to return to the lie at the heart of something like Jim Crow. Or apartheid, which is like, oh, we can just be apart, but it will be fine. We'll work together. We'll have parallel development. We don't want to return to those lies. We want to return to a real achievement of ourselves, achievement of European identity. And so I think this is why this is resonant and why we need to also get away from defining ourselves by past things that really aren't resonant. We don't want to define ourselves in terms of the Second World War. That was a terrible conflict, much like the Civil War. I don't think the battle lines of the Second World War are the same battle lines today. We need to get over it. And I think identitarianism is just this, it's this thing that resonates. And it's also something that you can respectfully deal with other cultures and races. We can respectfully encourage Africans to be identitarians, and Chinese and Japanese and Indians. I mean, it's a universalist, but then particular racial ideology. And I think this is also something that we need. We don't want to be in another situation where we are supreme over Africans. We've seen that, and that did not work. That was unworkable, and it led to this just endless moral whipping of ourselves about how evil we were. We want to achieve ourselves. We don't want to be supremacist over anyone. We want to recognize the other respectfully. So anyway, this is why I think identitarianism really, it makes sense. It is what we should be calling ourselves, and it is how we should think about ourselves. And, we're borrowing a great revolutionary concept from France. We've done that before.
The thing is, when Europe, like, they have a more sort of an organic sense of culture and identity, like, you have the same people with the same culture living in the same areas. The problem with the United mm-hmm. States is a lot of people don't have an authentic organic culture, and people are constantly moving around to different parts of the country, so they don't have a a strong regional identity. But obviously, American nationalism, that idea is garbage. But even with building identities on race, like, there's a lot of people, they may be of the same race, but they're going to be in conflict with each other. So America is just this, it's very chaotic and confusing to build a sort of identity the way it is in Europe.
I agree, but I think there's also a flip side to what you're saying. And the fact is, one of the big problems with Europe is that they can't get over viewing other Europeans as the other. And in some ways, for good reason. There are historical reasons for this. But if you can look at, say, Ukrainian identity, it is an identity about hating Russian identity and about hating Russians, willing to engage in really horrible military conflicts with Russians. It is to a lesser degree about hating Germans and Jews as well. And we have this concept of we want to view, in Europe, there's this concept of they want to view other Europeans as the other, and they're not seeing the big picture. They're not getting out of it and seeing that we have so much in common. I mean, we have so much in common mythologically, we have so much in common genetically, we have so much in common culturally and spiritually, and that we need to get out of this morass of ethnic hatred and suspicion and start seeing the big picture. And I think ethno-nationalists are unable to do this. I don't want to ever call myself an ethno-nationalist or even try to support any ethno-nationalist parties. I think some of the ethno-nationalist parties that are the most benign are the most stupid and liberal, like Scottish nationalism, where basically the Scots are arguing that we're not able to be leftist enough in the United Kingdom, so we need to achieve our own cute little society so we can be like Sweden. It is just truly stupid, Scottish nationalism. But then you can see the other side of that is this horrifying Ukrainian nationalism that is led to a tremendous amount of violence and death. You can see other stupid nationalisms like Quebecois ethno-nationalism, where they think, you know, the fact that they speak French language is so amazing, and we should bring in Haitian-speaking Frenchmen to Quebec because they're better than the evil Anglo-Saxons. Ethno-nationalism is a backward 19th-century concept. It is a ideology for losers, and it is nothing we want to be involved with. You can see this with Jobbik Party in Hungary. We're these great Hungarian parties. We're not like the Germans, despite the fact that our culture is defined by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Oh, we don't like them. We're not Western. We're Turkic and Asiatic. We're our own little special people that, of course, would easily be overwhelmed by another country because we're very small. But we hate other Europeans. We need to get away from this. This is leading nowhere. And if you want to say who benefits, the answer is obvious. People who want a weaker Europe, who want a weaker European people, benefit from keeping Europeans pitted against each other in these petty feuds. So I don't think we should support any of these things. So in a weird way, in an ironical way, Americans are better off than Europeans in the sense that they have a racial concept between WASP and the Irish, the animus between WASP and Germans, the animus between WASP and Scotch-Irish in the South or something like that. There are differences. I would certainly not deny that. If anyone's driven between, like, Pennsylvania and the South, I remember I was driving to Pennsylvania, and just once you reach this Germanic state, it just changes. I don't want to seem like I'm being mean. The South just has this quality. It's the redneck culture. It's more laid back. It's, you know, more rough, to be honest, kind of, you know, with. And then you get to Pennsylvania, and it's Germanic. It's more conformist. It's more alles muss in Ordnung sein. There really are ethnic differences, even in the United States. And certainly in the Northeast is different than people in the Pacific Northwest and so on. But those differences are not leading to violence. They are not leading to hatred or suspicion. And in a way, they're colorful, amusing ethnic differences, and that is great. That is fine. That is what we want. We want to increase those colorful differences that are not about violence and hatred. And so, in a way, America has achieved this racial identity. You are white, and that is something that Europe needs to learn from the United States. This is actually going to be my talk before I was thrown in prison by Viktor Orban. This was going to be my talk. It was about what can Americans learn from Europeans? And the answer to that is a lot. But also, what can Europeans learn from Americans? And I think we sometimes overlook that latter question when Americans look to Europe as, oh, look, it's so much better over there. They've got the Front National and they've got ethno-nationalist parties and they're connected with all this great, you know, history and architecture. And in America, we've got Walmart. I understand that and I think that's real. But we need to also look at what Europeans can learn from Americans, because actually America has achieved something. And that something is the absence of ethno-nationalist violence amongst white people. And that is a great thing.
We were talking about this earlier, about how when the economic Wall Street crisis happened, all these people were like, yeah, there's going to be a revolution. But then basically things sort of stabilized. What trends do you see happening in the future of the United States?
Well, I mean, this is a very difficult question. And I think there are a lot of future possibilities, and all of them seem kind of equally valid in the sense that they all emerge from some dominant trend. So I could envision a economic collapse and something like we see in the books by Piero San Giorgio or Gerald Salenti's various videos of, you know, starvation and gangs, you know, something like Mad Max. I think that's a possibility. I could also see basically a continuation almost indefinitely of this world we live in now. It's kind of going with a whimper and not a bang. It's becoming more and more decadent, becoming more and more impoverished, but the ability to be decadent becoming kind of cheaper. And so I could see that. I could see some kind of reversal. But, you know, again, I view things from a lens where I don't always see these things that people think are positive. I see maybe this kind of negative underside, and things that people think of negative, I see this positive underside. I can see a dialectical flip. And, you know, again, all of the nationalism that is going, there is a lot of nationalist parties that are going on in Europe, and that is great. Whether they can lead towards something higher or whether it's going to always go back to this reactionary nationalism, even with the Front National, you can see them degenerating. They're not even becoming French nationalists. They're almost becoming civic nationalists. They're becoming more Americanized in a way. But in America, if we're kind of on the far edge of these trends, are we going to in a way flip first? You know, if the great erasure of European heritage and history occurs in the United States before it occurs in Europe, are we in a way better positioned for this ideological flip that will happen when people will awaken? You know, I those are the kinds of things I think about. So I don't want to just go with something that, you know, Europe is better off or, you know, so on and so forth. I think that's kind of a little too easy for me. And whether something like the Front National leads to anything that's bigger than itself, I think it's a little bit dubious, to be honest. Front National seems to be getting worse, and it seems to be getting more Americanized and more civic. And it seems to be kind of becoming more and more of a kind of false consciousness.
It seems to be that American conservatism, I mean, American patriotism is mostly, it's more prevalent among older people. Didn't you write an article about the political views of millennials? And I forget if you wrote it or someone else, but it was like millennials are not as bad as like people think they are.
Yeah, I wrote that, yeah.
Okay.
Let me actually call that up. Yeah, I mean the American kind of cult, to get to this like issue of the culture war. the culture war is really something that certainly stretches back to the 80s in terms of the name, but it really stretches back to the 60s. It is a baby boomer's culture war. And it has to do with battles over the Vietnam War, over patriotism, and so on. And I think, you know, we're getting past those battles. And I don't always think that these cultural war, you know, hot button issues are really particularly relevant for us. I mean, with the gay marriage thing, I personally don't really resonate with the idea of gay marriage. It seems to be how do I go into this? Monogamy seems to be a very poor fit for gay men. It just seems to be a kind of, it just seems to be the kind of like latest expression of bourgeois conformism of like now even gays are going to get married and vote Republican. The idea that these gays have destroyed the sanctity of marriage or something is ridiculous. That has been destroyed by feminists. It's been destroyed by a lot of people, and it's been going on for some time. So in a way, I don't really care that much about gay marriage. It's not something that motivates me. And the people who are most actively against gay marriage, the religious right, are truly terrible on the issues that matter. They are, as in terms of race, they are as egalitarian or more so than any leftists you will meet. They are the ones who are actively involved in kidnapping people from other cultures, which of course is called adoption. But I think in the better called kidnapping people from other races and cultures, bringing them here, forcing them to become Americans. This is the kind of thing they resonate with. The religious right is so wrong on these issues that matter that I don't care if they're kind of right on gay marriage. I don't want them to win. I love the fact that they're being delegitimized because they've been horrible. And the kind of the Billy Grahams of the world, the Jerry Falwells, and worse, the Family Research Council. I hope these organizations are delegitimized and thrown into the dustbin because they suck. And so I don't really care that much about gay marriage. It's not something that motivates me. I would much rather talk about where we're going to be 100 years from now and not focusing on these little hot-button issues that motivate baby boomers. I don't think baby boomers themselves are kind of morally worse than anyone else. I think what it is, it's a product of their own lived experience. They were born after the Second World War. They experienced massive economic growth. Certainly there was an instability in the late 60s and 70s, but they also, as they reached middle age, they experienced a massive credit bubble to end all credit bubbles. They experienced the peak of American empire in the, say, 50s and early 60s. And they, experienced a point where the idea that there'd be something else is kind of unthinkable. So I don't blame them for, in a way, their lack of imagination, their lack of ability to see that there's something else, that we need to move further than just conserving the status quo. But they are kind of impoverished, you know. I mean, when you talk to people who are obsessed with things like immigration reform or something, and you tell them, if we end all immigration tomorrow morning, that just means that whites will become a minority in this country in 2058 as opposed to 2042 or something. You know, there's no big difference. Ultimately, the fate of our grandchildren is the same. They won't answer you. They have no answer because their imagination is impoverished. And they have no way of thinking outside of that. They have no other goal outside of just perpetuating an America that they have an image of in their mind from the 1980s. And so I think in a way, you know, millennials are better off than their parents. And I think in many ways we need to just get over the hot button issues of baby boomers. We need to get over thinking about abortion as something we care about, of gay marriage, that we should be caring about flag burning, or you know, whether people support the military enough or something. These just are not our issues, and they're just distractions. And so we need to think about, look, you know, gay marriage, that is ultimately not going to affect us. We want to radically refound marriage in a radical new way that is about the health of our people and our civilization. This is something that can't be touched by this, you know, these horrible people in the Supreme Court and some, you know, activists. They don't have that power over us. That's basically my. I'm rambling as usual, and I'm going off in a lot of different directions. But that's just my point. The culture war is a baby boomer war, and it's a war of an impoverished imagination, and it's not our war.
What do you see as like the top key principles that identitarians should focus on?
Well, I think we should focus on identity as a question that must be answered before any other question. You know, we can start thinking about the abortion question or the gay marriage question or whatever once we know who we are. And so, I mean, identitarianism at this point is a spiritual and intellectual movement. And again, that is the situation in which we're in of, you know, we are not, we obviously don't have political power, and we're not in a revolutionary situation. So we have to do this spiritual, ideological work that goes before a coming political movement, and that is indispensable for that political movement. So it's really about asking that question first of who are we. It's not about coming up with some new economics. Oh, we need more global economics, or oh no, we need a new kind of socialism. No, we need to ask who are we before we even think about those kind of practical, tactical questions.
Richard Spencer, I would like to thank you for being on. It's been a great show.
Well, I appreciate being on. It's a lot of fun talking to you.
That is all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.